Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening, good afternoon, everybody. This is the Matt Kwasaborski Show, calling you live and direct from a very chilly, rainy, yet going to be snowy, Prague, Czech Republic, the heart of Central Europe here, where winter is slowly creeping in with the temperatures and also with the weather. It's a beautiful day yesterday, but at night, I went out to meet some friends and then realized it was raining, so I was halfway to the tram stop. So it's that type of year where it can be sunny and rainy, you're not even sure about it. But anyway, that's not the topic of the weather. The topic is not the weather here today. The topic will be the NFL, and also we talk a little bit about politics that happened there. So first of all, before we begin, I'd like to thank Blog Talk Radio for having this venue. I'd like to thank Al Gore for inventing the internet, and I'd like to thank you, my loyal listeners, whether you're listening live or on the replay. I do appreciate it. And even if you're not, I'm really just trying to practice to start my own official podcast when a new website will be launched, hopefully relatively soon, and more details will follow there. So going around, I usually give you a briefing on what's new in the Czech Republic. The economy has been reporting being very strong here in the Czech Republic. Prices are rising a little bit, so to say. There was actually a butter scare here for a while, and I read that the butter prices will stabilize. No, really, it was close to approximately like $2.50, maybe $2.25 for a, it's not really a stick of butter, it's like 4 sticks of butter, but it's not the same size. Anyway, it was really expensive for this part of the year, for this part of the world, and also I think even for Americans to buy them, but the butter prices will be dropping and stabilizing. Within the political scene here, we still have the elections were won. They're still trying to figure out who will form the new government. Between ANO, as we talked about them, they've won 30% of the votes about, I think about almost a month ago now, or 3 weeks ago. And they're now trying to form their government here. And we also have President Trump. Went to Asia this week, the United States president, and he pretty much was again. Believes Russian President Vladimir Putin that Russia had no involvement in the elections. President Trump would say Putin would tell him that I didn't do that, and he says, well, I believe him. Just like some other American presidents in the past, namely George W. Bush, who said he looked in Putin's eyes and saw his soul. And it really is discouraging when 17 of the United States intelligence community organizations, CIA, FBI, NSA, and a bunch more all said, yes, the Russians interfered with the elections. There was articles published that the Russians interfered, and they sort of, in so many ways, there are also articles out there that say, yes, we did sort of interfere in the elections. And then Putin this week said he believes the United States will try to meddle in the upcoming presidential elections. Now, I don't know what kind of meddling the United States can do to get someone else elected, but again, it's just playing tit for tat. What bothers me for a while, excuse me, I still have this kind of drip in my throat. We'll see the doctor tomorrow. But what really bothers me about it's the way Trump looks at Putin. When you see the handshakes and the smiles, and they talk about like the Trump looks at him like he's an old friend. When you see these videos of what's happening in Asia, and also the old video from when they first met in face to face as President Trump in Munich, it really looked like Trump was just seeing an old friend he hasn't seen for a while, and kind of like, you know what, I'm sorry for all this stuff, the rest of the world's putting you through, but I really think you're a small guy. I also like Putin's sort of look on his face when Trump approaches him. And I think there's a moment of trepidation for Putin, because he's like, is he really going to shake my hand in front of all these people with that big smile, or is he going to start and actually lambast me for interfering in the elections and also with the his invasion of the Ukraine? It's quite just funny to see Putin's reaction. He doesn't really quite know what to make of it. But behind closed door, I guess progress is making going forward between the United States and Russia. And remember that I've said on these shows before and through Facebook that Trump, all the way back as early as 1987 or now, 30 years ago, promoted the idea of a grand alliance between the Soviet Union at the time, obviously, and the United States, that they should join forces. The two biggest nuclear arsenals in the world should join forces and not allow the rest of the world to have nuclear weapons. Well, that obviously has gone astray. As we know, other nations have nuclear capabilities, including parts of Western Europe, as well as India, Pakistan, China, and others that we probably don't know that are being developed. And obviously North Korea, which is another issue there. But that was his idea. So now you see that you see the cooperation being done between the United States and Russia on cybersecurity, which I think is also a farce because, you know, it's obviously the Russians are expert at hacking, as are Americans. And now they're sharing the way to control the internet together, probably in some cahoot, maybe China's involved as well. The other issue is that, you know, the Russians invaded part of Europe, annexed Crimea away from the Ukrainians, a situation that's very close to my heart. And they continue to occupy parts of the Donbas there. Russia is clearly interfering in Western elections in other places, namely Spain, which is having, unfortunately, some issues with its breakaway region of Catalonia, who has declared independence. Now, it's not all Russians going in. What Russia does is they just try to stir the pot and turn the citizens almost against themselves. They'll put fake articles out there. They will put, propaganda pieces out there, really trying to persuade the public sentiment within the nations to kind of turn against each other. You know, do you really want independence in Catalonia, or do you really want to be part of Spain and part of the EU, which is part of Putin's issue? He wants to break down bilateral. He wants to break down these international world figures such as NATO and the EU, and go back to the times of the pre-World War I. That's also the way Trump sees the world. Trump sees the world is that there should be spheres of influence, and we should go back to kingdoms rather than have real fledgling democracies and international cooperation, because that worked so well before World War I, when we just had bilateral relations. For the Americans, it was kind of different. You know, we were isolated being a part of the world through two oceans. You know, before World War I, there wasn't very many transatlantic airlines. There was no transatlantic flights. You had to take the long boat over the oceans to get to each continent, whether it was to Asia and the Pacific or Europe, Africa, and the West, or across the Atlantic to the East, sorry. And this is the kind of world that should go back where Russia had its domains over its lands, fought many wars. The Americans pretty much stayed out of world affairs, rebuilding from the Civil War until the Spanish-American War of 1898. And it really is interesting to see that I think China, Russia, and the United States are three big powers in the world. I would argue that China is blowing past us with Trump's sort of, getting out of international affairs, untangling the Americans out of international affairs. And a lot of it is playing right into Putin's hands, making America a lot weaker. You know, when Trump publicly states on his Twitter account that he believes in the old, in an old KGB, basically a KGB veteran member that Putin was part of the KGB, and the KGB still exists, just in a different name today. And there's consolidation of the security systems within Russia, and choosing to side with them over 17 different security apparatuses here in the United States is just a slap in the face to all the men and the women. I know a lot of diplomats. In my job, I get to work with the U.S. embassies around Central and Eastern Europe. I probably know people in the intelligence community. I'm just not aware of it. And it's just a shame that they're getting slapped in the face. The president is deciding to choose a former colonel in the KGB, or, you know, the leader of the KGB in Eastern Germany in the 1980s, over the United States intelligence community. But it goes part to the grand plan of deconstructing the state. Donald Trump thinks the way the world has gone, especially the United States, should be pulling out of international alliances. They should breaking down the State Department, reading just all of these articles, how there's not a lot of, not so much like top tier diplomats in the State Department anymore. There's also these career ambassadors. And our State Department works like this. In countries that are deemed relatively safe with a relatively strong democracy, such as Czech Republic, France, or the UK, the ambassadors tend to be political appointees. They were basic donors to campaign, and they get called upon to serve. And they usually serve as long as presidents, usually one or two terms, depending on the president's office. Countries such as countries like Ukraine or Pakistan, Kyrgyzstan, Ukraine, these countries where the rule of law really isn't clearly established, And there tends to be the threat of violence is much more greater than, say, in, let's say, a place like Germany, not giving the economic situation, not the economic, the migrant situation there, but relatively safe. They become career ambassadors, career State Department people, and they, those kinds of ambassadors are now missing. And it, he basically said before his Asia trip that says it doesn't matter what the policy is. I am the policy, or the policy goes through me. It only matters to me. You should not be asking Rex Tillerson where foreign policy is. I give the foreign policy, and it's Rex's job basically to carry this out. And you know, gutting the State Department was one of the things that all, that Trump, Tillerson, and Trump supporters in the money situation, probably the Mercer family, and all these people who see the world in a different way, loathing the fact State Department is gutted. If you don't, if you haven't met American diplomacy, diplomacy around the world, it really has helped create the way the world is, especially in Central and Western Europe, and slowly building its way in Ukraine. It probably hasn't happened the way in the Middle East, like the Americans' foreign policy thought it would. Obviously, Arab Spring was a complete disaster. In many ways, except for some countries that are able, such as Tunisia, that's holding on to democracy, counter-revolutions, and then you have the ISIS mess, which many, many people were murdered, killed, maimed, mostly Muslims. Obviously, we all know the famous Americans who were beheaded on the video. And basically, the American foreign policy at that time was not conducive because it did not evolve from what had happened in Europe when American foreign policy helped stabilize Europe after World War II, and it did. It really did. And these are the things that when international alliances that are criticized as the EU and NATO, and you can criticize them, nothing wrong with criticizing them, but it has been the longest amount of time of peace on continent Europe in the history of Europe within members of NATO members. And you also have this, you know, the situation with the EU. Once we started trading, once France and Germany created the coal and steel pact from the Treaty of 1951, it basically has ushered in pretty much a peaceful movement all throughout Europe. With there's no intra-nations fight. Yes, you had Yugoslavia breakup, which was a horrible disaster, but that also had to do with the fall of communism more, but less than that to do with the idea of American foreign policy going in. When communism began to fall within after Tito's death in 1980, Milosevic started his nationalistic movement as early as 1987 and really brought it to a head in the early to mid-1990s. But the idea is that Europe has been in a very peaceful situation throughout its for the longest period of time in history, thanks to NATO and also thanks to the original ideals of the EU. And no one seems to champion that in the West. And that is really a shame, and it should really be championed. And when I say the West, it includes Central and Eastern Europe where I'm living. I don't necessarily say Moldova and Georgia or even Ukraine, but pretty much all the other countries from the Baltics all the way down through all the way to Greece and all the way over to the ocean, through the Mediterranean Sea and to the coastlines of the Spain and Portugal, UK and France. I really think something that's not understood and not really embraced. Everyone thinks they can go out and make the world, think they can just get what's theirs, and that these international alliances are becoming hindrances to trade deals, to, you know, working together economically, politically. Politically, the situation stay within the nations, but economically, working together. And the world is so economically intertwined. Even China, the country that's run by the Communist Party itself, basically says globalization through economic further deepening the economic cooperation is the way to go for the future. Trump doesn't see it that way. He would rather create just different kind of trade deals with each and every nation on its own. Some of that does exist, and some of it doesn't. And I'm not saying there has to be the TPP has to go back into effect. I think it should. And Trump's only looking out for the American interests there. But when he goes on and not making America great again by routinely criticizing the intelligence community and siding with a KGB colonel in the KGB who's the president of Russia, I mean, it's absolutely a slap into the face for those thousands of Americans that have served our country, continue to serve our country, in very much virtual animosity. you don't really know who's working for what agency, whether it's the CIA or the State Department itself, but there's a lot of people that do both. There's a lot of people that work for the NSA that you don't know about. Then you have military intelligence, and you also have other apparatuses that could be working for the FBI internationally. And I really think it's a slap in the face. And he said this on Veterans Day, which is also something that is really, 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 really insulting to all the veterans out there. A lot of these people who are in the intelligence communities or become diplomats or ex-military people. They were soldiers at one time. They served and maybe a fault, maybe were stationed in Iraq, stationed in all the bases, all the different in Saudi Arabia. Maybe they're stationed in Germany, stationed in Japan. And they oftentimes become intelligence officers once military career is done. And to say that on Veterans Day, I doubt he even realized it was Veterans Day. That's how clueless I think he is sometimes to the perception of what he's doing. I don't think he's clueless to what he's doing, but I think he is a little bit clueless in that it was Veterans Day there. I think what I'm trying to say is I do believe that Trump knows what he's doing. I don't think he realized it was Veterans Day, but he said it on Veterans Day. I don't think he realizes that so many people in the intelligence community are former soldiers. That's what he's trying to get at. And that really is a shame. And it's really embarrassing. You know, I work over here in Prague, as you know, for a long time. I've been working here 5 years, living here 12, 13 years in the summer program. And in a way, I'm not with any sort of agencies. You know, I think a lot of people think that I am, but I'm not. Right? I'm basically this American who works in higher education administration. But I also consider myself to kind of be on the front lines of this as an American, bringing sort of the American appeal of our higher education system to different areas within Central and Eastern Europe and the Middle East. You know, I do believe that I'm on a mission, not a mission that, you know, was granted by the United States government or anything like that, but just on my own mission. And it really is striking to see, you know, what's happening over here, how it will affect America, because we're no longer isolated. You know, our system was attacked. Our democracy was attacked by the Russians. I do believe that. I do think the United States has also played hands in elections around the world, but I'm not going to say, hey, an eye for an eye. It's not the way it goes. You know, a lot of times when Americans were involved in different democracies, of course it was business interests. There's business interests for Russia to be in cahoots with Donald Trump and the Republicans who have a lot of business interests in Russia, including Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, who sits on the board of the largest gas company, Rosneft, in Russia. And that's, I think, is highly embarrassing. There's no sense of values in terms of, no, you don't cross the line. I will not do business with the government of Russia when I do not support the fact that there is not really freedom of press, when there's a lot of murdering of journalists, when there's arresting of business people because they are successful. And it's not the government, but the government has the power, so they will arrest them. I don't support that. I think eventually you draw the line. Is there anything wrong with doing business with Russian businesses or entrepreneurs who are not really linked to the government? Absolutely not. You should be looking out for those kinds of business interests. But eventually, you know, you should not be sitting on the board of a major Russian gas company walking the Commerce Secretary. Say, you know, people that were hoping Trump was going to bring back jobs and all of these things, when is he going to bring back the jobs to America that he shipped over to China or that his daughter Ivanka has? If you want to make America great again and bring jobs back, start with your own businesses. Bring those back. You know, stand up a little bit for American pride and American history a little bit more, and not just looking out for the bottom line and making sure your friends are getting great deals, you know, and trying to almost begin your own sense of authoritarianism. So many people predicted this, and even those in the denial that Russia was not involved and it's all one big hoax and the Democrats made it up and the liberal media made it up, the fact is you elected an authoritarian leader. You supported an authoritarian leader. There was nothing in Donald Trump's campaign that when you listen to the lexicon of his, in his language, you never heard those democracy, constitution, liberty, freedom. You rarely heard those words. It was just make America great again, and we're getting screwed by the rest of the world. And that message by Donald Trump is not old. It's a very old message. You can look at, if you Google him, or you Google him on YouTube, and look at some of his interviews from 1980, 1985, 1987, either through videos that were on TV, CBS, 60 Minutes, whatever have you. You can find these interviews. He's saying the same thing back then. It's just the countries were different. You know, and this is what, you know, Donald Trump is a business person. He's not a politician in the sense of that. And yes, let's get these business people in. These business people who have created their own empires, and hey, he created his own empire. That's great. I'm very happy that he's a successful businessman. But these guys that create their own empires are used to walking into the room, the boardroom, whatever room it is, saying this is what I want done, this is what this is, and this is what needs to be done. Get it done or you're out of here. And they walk out of the room, they go back and they play another round of golf or make phone calls to their friends to ensure the bigger deals. Whatever made people think that Trump wasn't going to slowly deconstruct our state, make it into a more authoritarian state, really is really just being naive. I have a lot of Republican friends who supported Trump, but I don't think they realize they're making he's making us into an authoritarian state. A lot of Republican friends that didn't support Trump, and they see the dangers of it, and they think that the system that's in place, that's often called the deep state by all of these alt-right guys, pro-Trump guys, are eventually going to save us. In some ways, they may. You know, this investigation into the Russian meddling by Robert Mueller, you know, we'll see if our rule of law and Constitution is strong enough to keep the America going. Yes, we have to do, yes, we have a horrendous century, not century, I shouldn't say century, since the beginning of, since September 11th, our foreign policy in the Middle East, and you can go all the way over to Pakistan and India and Afghanistan, it's been a mess. It's been an absolute quagmire. But before that, when the Cold War was happening here, mainly in Europe, these democracies, and once the wall came down, the ability to set up democracies, and not say come in and this is how you're going to do it, and a lot of people call the EU just puppets of America or American puppets, it's not about that. You know, you go into these countries, of course, you know, of course these countries are going to turn to the biggest successful democracy in history and say, how did you do this? Give us some advice. You know, we want you to come in and teach us how it's done. We want you to show us how to have parliamentary elections. How do you establish the rule of law? You know, how do you establish getting foreign direct investment? What does it really mean to have the Constitution protect individual rights over the government rights? That's a success. That has been a success. And it's also been a success, you can say, in Japan as well. I don't have much exposure or really been to that part of the world yet, so I don't really speak on that. But Japan can be looked upon as one of those successes. India has a successful democracy. You know, and I think these are the things that we're going to find out to see what clash and what's really going to win. I mean, you can even see China, for example. They're a communist state. There's many, many human rights abuses, especially when it comes to workers. But they're not. Their economy is not capital economy. Their economy is not communist by any state of the imagination. They're a capitalist economy. A capitalistic economy, or market economy, was driven by Americans and Western Europeans, and go all the way back to Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations, who was a Scotsman. And that is the kind of, when you see a country that was communist, that still is communist, embrace that economic model, it's a sense of a miracle. And now they're the ones leading the way, bringing the international come together when the United States is backing away for whatever reason. You know, usually you see these things happen when our economy shambles. Our macro economy is not in shambles. It was not in shambles when Trump took office. Same thing here in Czech Republic. The economy was rising again. You know, and then they still have the elected business leaders going to run the country like a business. And again, it's, you know, I've lived in the big cities of Philadelphia, New Orleans, Washington, Prague, capital cities, basically. Obviously, New Orleans is not Philadelphia, but you get the idea. Like, I see the economic development here. It is the people out in the countryside. But they're starting to see the benefits, too. You know, those benefits are reaching out. That's why economics is really a market economy, goes in waves. It has ups and downs. It has its correction. It has its service moments. And when you see these politicians, hardly any of them in this election realm in Austria, Germany, France, here in Czech Republic, they weren't campaigning on, oh, the economy is in dregs anymore, and we're going to be the one that's going to prove it. France a little bit. But that message was really gone. Couple of years ago, 2012, in the last elections, yes, that was the big issue of the economy. Now they use this fear that we're going to be overrun by Muslim extremists, and they're all going to want to make us a part of the caliphate state. And that's what they really championed on. That was one of the things that got some of these nationalistic leaders elected in countries like Austria. You know, here in the fourth place, or in the Czech Republic, we have a very nationalistic party that wants basically control of the security apparatuses. That's what they are going for. Really got on a diatribe here. Really haven't talked much about American sports, but I think I'm just really upset with President Trump, who is president, supposed to be representing America, constantly embracing Russian President Vladimir Putin. It's embarrassing. It really is embarrassing. It's embarrassing to the intelligence communities when he gets on Twitter and just insults them all. That no, the Russians, I believe Putin over the American intelligence community. I know that's part of what he wants to break down. Steve Bannon, his advisor, who's now out of the White House, calls himself a Leninist, not a communist, but a Leninist. He wants to break the state down. And that's what Lenin did during the October Revolution 100 years ago, the Bolshevik Revolution. They got rid of, you know, they purged in a very violent way the security apparatus for Russian Czechists, who then went on to become the model of the secret police around the Soviet Union. Those guys were hated. They were feared because they would murder people with no authority from above. They would kidnap them just based on their own judgment. There was no courts. Yeah, there were courts, but there were show trials. But a lot of people disappeared in the Czechoslovakia. And whatever the United States, Trump, and Tillerson are doing to our State Department and not filling these roles, and what they're doing with it is really scary. It really is. You know, they're going to start grooming young Trumpists to go in there and put what kind of foreign policy are we going to have? You know, it really is kind of a scary thing. 45 minutes to go in the show. It was a 45 show, sorry, and we have about 17 minutes to go. But there's another thing I want to riff upon this time, but I'll try to keep it within the next 10 minutes to get to the NFL. If you're a fan of baseball, you know, Major League Baseball in America, one of the greatest pitchers of the 2000 era was Roy Halladay, who pitched a long time, 12 years in Toronto, and then he pitched in my hometown, the Philadelphia Phillies, for the last four seasons of his career. And he was a guy that just everyone loved, everyone admired. And he was a fantastic story until Tuesday, when he crashed his private jet or plane, I guess it wasn't a jet, it was a plane, into the Gulf of Mexico and died at 40 years old. And it's hard when these things happen, when you watch someone who has success and they have success for your team. And I think the thing about Roy Halladay was he was not only a great competitor, a Hall of Famer on the field, but off the field, he was just a stand-up guy. He was the classical American story. He really was. He stood 6'6". If you're into centimeters, that's 2 meters plus. You know, he was a big guy. He married his high school sweetheart. They had two kids. Then he goes in. Then he gets drafted in the first round of the major leagues by the Toronto Blue Jays. And by the time he makes it to the major leagues, I forget the year, but early in his career, I'd say 98. I think he was drafted in 95, 96. He stunk. He was awful. He was just horrendous. And the Toronto Blue Jays sent him back down to the minors, and he rebuilt his career. It wasn't that he was lacking the physical tools. It was more the mental approach that he took to the game. And when he went back to the minor leagues, he listed in a sports psychologist or maybe even a psychiatrist, and who really rebuilt his mental frame of mind. And then he put that together with his talents. They worked on his mechanics, of course, to make him a better major league pitcher. And he came up and was one of the most dominant pitchers you will ever see in the history of baseball, especially from the years, I think he came back up maybe in 2001, 2002, and he pitched all the way through 2010. For about 10, 12 years there, he was the best pitcher in baseball consistently. And he, unfortunately, after, you know, and then he retires. He pitches for the Toronto Blue Jays, who were never very competitive. And in 2010, 2009, the Philadelphia Phillies wanted to trade for him. They could not agree on compensation for Roy Halladay in terms of players giving back to Toronto. So the Phillies traded for Cliff Lee in 2009. We went to the World Series. Then that offseason, they make the trade for Roy Halladay. He signs a 3-year, $60 million contract with the Phillies for the most dominant pitcher in the game. Yeah, that was not a lot of money, $20 million per year. So he took a team-friendly contract because he knew the Phillies still needed to sign some other people. And they go out and they re-sign Cliff Lee a year later. Unfortunately, they were never able to get to the back of the World Series after Roy Halladay became a member of the Phillies. But his first season, he pitches a perfect game in Miami. And if you ever, Miami is one of the hottest places with the humidity in May time. It was May. It was a night game in May when he's tough. He pitches a perfect game. Then that year in 2010, he goes in the very first game against the Cincinnati Reds and no hits them, becoming only the second major league pitcher in history to throw a no-hitter in the playoffs. And it was just a magical, magical ride for Roy Halladay with the Toronto Blue Jays and Philadelphia Phillies. By 2012, he was pitching with the Phillies and his arm was shot. And by the way, one of my favorite games was Roy Halladay's debut in Washington, D.C. against the then lowly Washington Nationals. The game was in April. It was actually on Easter Monday. I think it was around April 6th or April 13th. But a couple of months, I was up in Philadelphia visiting my family, and they said they're coming down with a bunch. This was Valentine's Day. My family goes to me and said, "We're coming down with a bunch of Phillies to watch the opening game." They're like, "Guess how many people in February they're coming?" I was like, two buses, 250 people, maybe more than two buses, obviously. They go, "No, 1,500 people." I was like, "What?" In February, there are already 1,500 people registered to travel on opening day down to that stadium. Luckily, I could just take the Metro and go back to my flat. And there had to be way more than 1,500 by the time the game time rolled around. And watch Roy Halladay pitches a complete game opening day. The Phillies massacre the Nats 11-1. It was like 22 degrees Celsius or 70 degrees out. I was there with my best friend in Washington and my uncle, just watching the game and just shooting the breeze, as we say. And it was just magical to watch this guy. And we're like, wow, we're really going places with him. And he's a great competitor. After his career, he takes up flying. And he takes it up as his hobby. His dad was a pilot. Not commercial airlines, just flying here and there. And on Tuesday, he crashed. Oftentimes, I know of another guy who was a Romanian friend of mine who took up piloting and crashed off the east coast of Florida about 4 years ago, and that was very sad to see him go. And it was sad to me to see Roy Halladay, you know, a guy like this, you know, the all-American guy, just crash and die at such a young age. He's 2 years younger than me, you know, 2 years younger than my best friend that I grew up with. And, you know, It was hard. It was hard to see that. He's very a guy that I admired. And going back to the way he rebuilt himself mentally, he also did it physically. But then he put every day he was in the gym at 5 a.m., every day working out. He was famous for working out after starts. Like, he knew he had to keep his body in pristine physical condition. And it rubbed off on a lot of people in Toronto, in the major leagues, on the Philadelphia Phillies. So many stories reading about Phillies and how Halladay changed their mindset and changed their careers and made them be better people. You know, also Halladay, when he wasn't flying planes, he was coaching high school baseball in Clearwater, Florida, somewhere near the Clearwater area, you know, volunteering, you know, doing these types of things. And what a tragic way to go. And the reason I also bring this up is because there was an asshole shock jock sports radio announcer in Boston who used this situation, this tragic situation, to improve his rating. Now, there's a difference between message and delivery. His message was that Roy Halladay, for all the responsibilities he had, should he have been flying planes solo? And to go back, there was a videotape. Two or three guys were on a boat taping Roy Halladay. They didn't know it was Roy Halladay, but they saw the plane. It went to one of the American media outlets called TMZ Sports, and Halladay was. He was flying very low in shallow water. And you see the way he's going up and down and around, and it's like, wow, he really was flying very recklessly. And the screen goes black for a pitch second, which was the crash, and then the next thing you see is these guys over the plane where the debris was. They didn't obviously do anything. And the only thing you see is, like, wow, you can see his shirt. They had no idea who it was. But this radio announcer said, you know, what is he doing flying his plane like that when he's got a wife, kids, responsibilities to all these people? And that message I agree with, but it's the way he delivered it. He delivers it by calling Roy Halladay a moron, that he deserved everything that happened to him, and that he was tragic, he was stupid, and really it was so, you know, Trumpish, I will say. Anything to do to get the ratings. It's one thing to go out and say that he was, you know, he was in the wrong, he should not have been flying that way, he was very reckless, and when you're going to be that reckless, these accidents happen. And they happen a lot often than we know, you know, we probably realize. We just know because he was a sports figure. But to call him a moron, to place all the blame, you know, well, it is his fault, Roy House, but just to call him a moron and sort of blast him using this moment when his friends and his family, his poor wife and kids have to deal with it, and this guy's using it to improve his ratings. And why I say it was very Trumpish, if you go back to the campaign, one of the memorable things that I'll always from the campaign was Trump mocking a reporter with physical handicap. Not only disabled, I don't remember the condition, but everyone knows it. And Trump just, you know, shakes his hand kind of violently in his head and mocks the way the guy talks about. Trump was critical. Trump didn't like the journalist because he wrote a critical piece about Trump a long time ago. But people remember that, and that was using the ratings. And you see that replayed over and over. Or Trump always going to the extreme, you know, blasting Megyn Kelly, the journalist. Say what you want about Megyn Kelly as a journalist, whether you think she's good or not, but then to, you know, mock her saying, well, I saw blood coming out of her eyes. He's just doing it for the ratings. You know, does he have to really go to that area where blood is coming out of her eyes, you know, in reference to her menstrual cycle? And that's exactly what this shock jock did. And he just basically calling him a moron, he just went and did what Donald Trump did to get the ratings. You know, I think this guy is an asshole and he's a slime ball for doing it. And I don't respect Trump at all for the way he campaigned. Some of it was very brilliant when it wasn't mocking people for their shortcomings, you know, or just mocking women because they have menstrual cycles. No, it was, you know, and, you know, he won the presidency. But those were the moments where it was like, this is ridiculous that this guy's going to win or this guy won. And this shock jock just used the same example. It's one thing to get ratings. It's one thing to be critical. But you don't have to step to the next level. It just lowers yourself in people's eyes. You know, the shock jock also used to say, well, I know about a guy who used to hang out with grizzly bears. I mean, you know, studied them. He's like, and guess what happened? He got eaten by the grizzly bears. I was rooting for the grizzly bears. It's one thing to say you're rooting for them. It's like if you were rooting for Roy Halladay to crash his plane because he was flying recklessly. And Roy Halladay was flying recklessly. But that doesn't make him a moron. It doesn't make Roy Halladay a moron because he crashed his plane. He meant many to so many people, including myself, just watching him and admiring him. Damn, I wish I had the motivation to get up every day at 5 a.m. to be in the gym at 5 a.m. And I should be. I really should. Anyway, it was such a tough week with what's going on, only in the last couple of days. And it just really hit home, especially Halladay, and especially when I think of my friends in the State Department. You know, and ones that I don't know that are in the intelligence communities, whether in the intelligence communities in other nations or not, or the state, they're in their own diplomatic corps. I admire these guys sacrificing their families to be promoting the American ideals from country to country, and to be pretty much just shunned upon by your own president by saying, I believe in Vladimir Putin, the former colonel in the KGB, over my own intelligence agency. It's just embarrassing sometimes. You know, once in a while, you know, I'm not critical because I'm a globalist or I'm a Democrat or anything like that. It's just the pristine of this position. You know, there's no respect for the people who came before Trump. He doesn't respect the office at all. At all. And that's one thing as Americans, we're taught to respect our leaders, but also be able to hold them accountable and also be able to be criticized there. Because that comes with the territory. It's not fun. But that's what comes with the territory. It's Trump saying after he's elected, well, I thought the media would be nice to me now that I'm president. No, it gets worse. Now we have you for 4 years, if you make it that long, or God forbid 8 years, or God forbid longer than that, if you do turn this the America into an authoritarian state. I don't know. It was very disappointing to Halladay to see this shock jock in Boston or listen to him just call him a moron. It's just absolutely demeaning and disrespecting Roy Halladay, his family, and disrespecting himself in a way, lowering his standards to do something to follow in the way Trump run his campaign. This guy used a page out of the Trump campaign book, say anything to get the ratings. Doesn't matter how bad it is. Slamming a guy, you know, slamming his family almost. You know, they're an extension of him. His kids are a part of him. I don't know. It was just a really tough week to watch and that stuff. Luckily, hopefully other things are moving in different ways. All right, there's only 4.5 minutes to go. Excuse me. 5-7-1 last week puts me under 500 for the season. So therefore, if I owed money to a bookie, if I bet with a bookie or online system, I'd owe one Czech crown or one U.S. dollar or $4 or 4 Czech crowns. Not as many surprising games last week that I lost. But now week 10 is here, and this is usually when I start betting money, if I did bet money. I did back in the day. But briefly just going through them. Minnesota Vikings off a bye going to Washington Redskins, who are coming off a great win for them in Seattle last week, but a very hard-fought one. They go up at home, traveling back, playing another great defense in the Vikings. Vikings are favored by 1.5. Take the Vikings on the road. Green Bay, I thought they were going to be able to shake off the rust of having Brett Hundley as a quarterback. They got beat on Monday night pretty badly by the Lions, 30-17. And it goes to show that the Green Bay defense hasn't stepped up. They go into Chicago, has been very competitive lately. Let's see what Chicago did last week. Maybe they were off last week. They've been playing very conservative, old-school football. Run the ball, and play defense. They'll beat Green Bay by 5.5 at home. Pittsburgh goes into Indianapolis. Pittsburgh is coming off a bye. They're favored by 10 on the road. I'm taking Indy at home. I predicted that Indy would cover last week at Houston, and I'm not surprised that Indianapolis won that game, and they won that game relatively easy last week, 20-14. Look for Indy's starting to play defense. I think they cover. I think Pittsburgh wins the game, but Indy covers. The L.A. Chargers go back across to the East Coast to play the Jacksonville Jaguars. Their defense is really stepping up. Jacksonville's favored by 5. I take Jacksonville. They also get Leonard Fournette back, I think, this week off of suspension. The Jets go into the lowly Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Tampa Bay, they look lost again when this is supposed to be their sort of year to show that they're progressing. Their quarterback is also out, Jameis Winston. Don't ever look at his pregame routine, especially for last week. I'm looking at the face of DeSean Jackson watching him. Now you have Ryan Fitzpatrick, who is a great veteran and probably has revenge on the mind against the Jets for the way the Jets did him. But still, I say the Jets cover the points. They're in the battle for the division. Tampa season's virtually over. Cincinnati goes into Tennessee. Two teams, you can't really tell what's going to happen. They're both been up and down. Tennessee's favored by 4.5. I take Tennessee. I think Cincinnati's coach is at the end of the line as well. New Orleans Saints go into Buffalo. Buffalo getting beat last week at home badly by the Jets, but had 9 days off. And Buffalo kind of usually plays well at home. The Saints get out of the dome and they go into cold Buffalo. I say take Buffalo. Even though the Saints are favored with the points, I think Buffalo wins and covers. Cleveland goes into Detroit. Cleveland's just an absolute mess. Maybe I can be the new general manager next year. Would absolutely love the chance to do that. I can't do any worse, even though I'm living in Prague. Detroit's favored by 11. Take Detroit. They're also still in the hunt for the wild card and the division. Dallas goes into Atlanta, the first game of the Ezekiel Elliott's suspension. Atlanta's favored by 3.5. Take Dallas with a point. I'm still not sold on Atlanta. They came back and won against the Jets. I think last week they're on a bye. They lost in Carolina, 2017, they're favored. I still say Dallas with the points. Atlanta may win by a field goal, but not cover. This is the week San Francisco gets off the schneid. They play the Giants, who are absolutely humiliated by the LA Rams at home in one of the worst games ever. The Giants are done. They've imploded. They've tuned out their coach. San Francisco is trying to build something. They're back home for the second week in a row. Giants have nothing to play for. Take San Francisco, even though the Giants are favored by 2.5. So even if the Giants win by 2, you win. New England goes into Denver. Denver, who got absolutely smashed by my Philadelphia Eagles last week, 51-17. I picked the Eagles to win, but Denver to cover. That didn't happen. New England's going to go in. They're going to see what the Philadelphia Eagles did, and they're going to, you know, use some of the same game plan. And I just think Denver's offense is putrid. New England covers the 7.5 points on the road. Miami goes into Carolina on Monday night. Miami's a mess. After trading their running back, even though they only lost by 3 to Oakland, I still think Carolina will cover. Carolina's starting to win some games again. And then I missed the Houston Texans going to the LA Rams. LA Rams are favored by 12. Take the LA Rams. Inspire the inspiration, everyone. Do not wait for the inspiration to inspire you. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.